From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, we'll hear from the next Speaker of Michigan's House and what he hopes to accomplish.
One of my top priorities coming into next term will be to ensure that we give our roads the proper funding that they need.
The Blue Wave makes a big splash in Oakland County. Longtime Executive L. Brooks Patterson will face his very first county commission controlled by Democrats.
That 1970s mindset has to change. We don't have time for the barriers to progress that have existed in the past.
A new idea that could help the millions evicted from their homes in this country every year.
An eviction really turns your life upside down. I call it civic death.
And we'll preview a whole batch of musicals that are opening up around Michigan with theater talk. Those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. Hello there and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. State lawmakers have their new leadership team in place. The new majority leader for the Senate will be Republican Mike Shirkey of Clark Lake. We spoke with him last Friday on Stateside. And the new House Speaker will be Republican Lee Chatfield of Levering in Emmett County. He's here now with us. Representative, welcome. It's good to have you here.
Hey, thank you very much, Cynthia, for having me on. It's a pleasure to be here.
So what message did you hear from Michigan voters last week?
Well, obviously, considering the outcome, Michigan is going to experience a split power in state government, and we haven't experienced that in the last 8 years. So, you know, I think I'm excited about the opportunity to come into Lansing next term with the Republican caucus in the majority. I'm excited to work with Democrat Minority Leader Kristi Gregg and Senator Shirkey, who's the Senate Majority Leader, as well as Governor-elect Whitmer. And I think there were many mixed messages, Cynthia, across the state, and it depends on which region you were from. But at the end of the day, our state's come a long way in the past 8 years, and we have to continue working together and coming up with solutions and ensuring that state government works so we can continue serving the people and moving our state forward.
Governor-elect Whitmer says she wants to get back to the custom of holding quadrant meetings where the governor sits down with the majority and minority leaders of the House and of the Senate. What do you think about that idea?
I think it's an important step. I mean, listen, it's no surprise to the people of our state that there are going to be differences between those in the legislature and those in the executive, right? That's why we have different parties. That's why we run on different campaigns and we have different platforms. But at the end of the day, it's not the differences that will define you. It's how you can come together and compromise and come up with solutions. And the only way you can come together and have solutions for our state is if you have a relationship. Because at the end of the day, Cynthia, if state government doesn't work, then our schools aren't funded. If state government doesn't work, our roads aren't funded. And if state government doesn't work, then the people aren't served. And we have to find a way as leaders to make sure we are coming together to provide real solutions for the people. Though we'll have differences, we're going to let the process work. And I think Governor-elect Whitmer is very familiar with the process, having come from the legislature, and we're excited about the partnership.
So that idea of face-to-face regular meetings, I think I hear you say they'll be helpful?
I think it's essential if you're going to get things done. You have to have that relationship. We will have differences, but many of them will be ironed out, and I will continue advocating and fighting for many of the things that myself and my Republican colleagues ran on. But when we're talking about fixing car insurance, when we're talking about fixing our roads, when we're talking about holding state government accountable through the Open Records Act, those issues are not partisan issues. They should not be defined by being a Republican or a Democrat. These are issues that serve the entire state. And it's incumbent on us as leaders, we are given the express obligation of making sure state government works, and that's what we intend to do.
I think it's pretty clear from the election results, Michiganders bought into Governor-elect Whitmer's fix the damn roads message. They want their roads fixed. The legislature passed a big road funding bill in 2015, but the full $1.2 billion a year won't kick in until 2021. And of course, earlier this year, the legislature unanimously voted to devote an extra $175 million to roads. Is that enough in your view?
I think it's important to note that we funded the roads at the highest level we ever have in this last budget cycle. I think Governor Snyder has done an excellent job through his leadership ensuring that we have a healthy economy that's strong, moving our state forward. And we are funding our roads. But the fact is this, you're right. We need to do more, and our roads need more funding. One of my top priorities coming into next term will be to ensure that we give our roads the proper funding that they need. You know, when we're looking at the role of government and what our responsibility is, infrastructure funding is near the top. And it's tough for us to sell ourselves as being pure Michigan and having a recovering economy when our roads and infrastructure are crumbling, So I look forward to having that conversation with Governor-elect Whitmer and Senate Majority Leader Shirky and finding out ways that we can come together and ensure our roads get more funding.
Governor-elect Whitmer has said she'd like to create that so-called infrastructure bank funded by $2 billion in state funds that could leverage another billion in federal dollars. What do you think of that idea, and where would you like to see more funding for roads come from?
Well, I look forward to having a more in-depth conversation with Governor-elect Whitmer, and I don't want to get started off on the wrong foot by giving an answer without having a conversation with her first. But I would tell you my personal opinion is that we have a road funding problem in our state. The problem is that we pay three taxes at the pump. We pay a per-gallon tax, a state tax, we pay a per-gallon federal tax, and we pay a sales tax. The problem is only two of those taxes actually go to fix the roads. The sales tax is not. I do think we need to have a structure put in place in our state that ensures all the money we spend at the pump goes to roads. That's what the majority of states do, and I think that's the root of our problem. Having said that, I look forward to having a conversation with Governor-elect Whitmer and finding ways that we could come together, come to some agreements, and get things done.
Last week, here on Stateside, Whitmer said she opposes the deal Governor Snyder made with Enbridge to build that tunnel under the Straits of Mackinac to eventually replace Line 5. How would you like to see this issue of Line 5 addressed?
Well, I applaud Governor Snyder for bringing Enbridge to the table and holding them accountable and ensuring that oil and natural gas liquids that are transported through our state are done so in a safe and responsible way. The fact is this, we're going to use this energy infrastructure and these resources every single day. This is something that many of Michigan residents depend on, but we need to ensure that we're transporting them in the safest method possible. You know, this Line 5 runs right through the heart of my district. I represent Northern Michigan and the Eastern Upper Peninsula. This is the heart of my district. It's the heart of our economy, and it's who we are. We need to make sure that it's protected. We need to make sure it's done the right way. I applaud the direction that Governor Snyder is taking, and I think we need to do everything we can to hold pipeline operators accountable in our state, because we are the Great Lakes State. And if we're the Great Lakes State, we need to ensure the Great Lakes are protected, and that's what I intend on doing.
Are you comfortable with that 10-year period that it's going to take to build that tunnel?
Well, I think they're going to expedite it as quickly as they can, and I think it's a necessary first step. And whether it's 7 years, whether it's 10 years, we need to get active on it immediately. But I would tell you this, Cynthia, that's why we passed out of the House a month ago bills of mine that hold pipeline operators accountable so we as a state have access to their maintenance. We have access to their inspection of those pipelines. And we know in real time what they're doing. We know what their insurance policy is. So I think my bills are a necessary first step until that tunnel is completed. But again, I applaud the direction, because we always need to ask ourselves, how can we transport this oil in a safer way?
Representative, at age 30, you will be the youngest House Speaker in Michigan history, perhaps the youngest in state legislatures across the country. How do you think that your age will inform the way you lead?
Well, I'm happy to have a strong Republican caucus behind me, people who I think have served well over the past several years. And we've proven that we can work hard across the state. The fact is, the House of Representatives is not about me. It's not about me as a leader. It's about all of us colleagues coming together, finding a way that we can come up with solutions. I look forward to working with each and every one of my colleagues, and as well as the Minority Leader, Christy Gregg, to find ways that we can improve our state.
GOP Representative Lee Chatfield, who will be the next Speaker of Michigan's House. Thank you so much for speaking with us on Stateside.
Thank you, Cynthia.
This week, a group of faith leaders is leading a caravan of protesters 1,700 miles from Ann Arbor to the Tornillo Detention Center in Texas. That's where the federal government's holding hundreds of unaccompanied minors who cross the border, many of them illegally. The caravan hopes to call attention to increasingly long detentions there for children as young as 13 and show other examples of what activists call a broken immigration system. Michigan Radio's Tracy Samilton reports.
One by one, cars pull into the parking lot of Temple Beth Emeth in Ann Arbor. It's 7 o'clock Monday morning, dark, cold. Rabbi Josh Winston rallies the troops.
So I have a bunch of Zingerman stuff. I got some espresso brownies.
Yeah, that's what I want.
They don't linger long. By nightfall, the caravan will need to make it to St. Louis, Missouri, on the first day of a three-day journey to Texas. The trip came about after Winston was asked to help an immigrant woman whose three children were taken from her at the border this summer. It took her more than 2 months to get them back. Hearing the story shook him up. He heard that unaccompanied minors were being detained for long periods in a remote tent encampment in Texas.
So my congregant says to me, what's happening in Tornillo is tearing me apart. What should I do, Rabbi? And I thought, you know, you're doing exactly what I would do. You're giving donations. It's what I'm doing. I don't know what else to tell you. But I knew that I couldn't respond that way. And so I said, let's go down.
He says he understands the immigration system was broken long before Donald Trump was elected. But he says now, policies like family separation and proposed policies like indefinite detention seem designed to inflict the most pain possible.
That just feels cruel to me. I believe that we can have strong borders and still be compassionate with people, that we can still treat people in a humane way.
Winston scheduled interfaith rallies along the way. At each stop, one or two more people join the caravan. At a rally in Indianapolis, Imam Ahmad Al-Amin tells the crowd that it's wrong for Americans to vilify immigrants and refugees. Noah and Moses, he says, were refugees once. Jesus and Muhammad.
We learn from this that being refugee is not a shame. These are the best of the mankind.
The rallies are also an opportunity to show that immigrants face threats throughout the country, not just at the border, like Minor Clemente. He came to this country from Guatemala when he was 15 to join his father. He qualified to stay in the U.S. under the DREAM Act. One day, ICE knocked on his door, and he let them in, figuring he was in good standing.
En ese momento, me encadenaron como si fuera un delincuente.
And at that moment, they handcuffed me as a delinquent.
An immigration judge eventually let him stay. So Clemente's story has a happy ending. But Alex Garcia's story, so far, does not. Garcia is in sanctuary protection in Christ Church UCC in Maplewood, Missouri, another stop on the journey to Tornillo. The 37-year-old Honduran man came to the U.S. as a young man, married, had 5 kids. He was given a stay of deportation in 2015 and 2016, but that changed after the election.
Hello, everyone. My name is Alex. I have been living in the church for 14 months, struggling to be able to return with my family.
The caravan continues to Tulsa, Oklahoma next, then Dallas, then El Paso, and finally Tornillo, another 1,100 miles. People who couldn't join the caravan will be flying to Texas for the last big rally outside the confines of the detention center, which is being expanded to be able to house up to 3,800 unaccompanied minors. I'm Tracy Samilton, Michigan Radio News.
And much more ahead. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Time to check on the latest offerings from professional theater companies all around Michigan as we say hello to David Kiley of Encore Michigan. And seems we're in a musical mood for this edition of Theater Talk, starting right out with the Michigan Opera Theater.
That's right. This past weekend, they opened The Barber of Seville. Now, opera fans know this one very well. It's a total crowd pleaser. It may be the most beloved opera ever, actually. It's by Rossini. It's based on a French comedy written in the late 1700s. The story is about a young, beautiful woman, Rosina, who falls for Almaviva, and vice versa. They could fall for each other. Trouble is, Rosina has a much older guardian, Dr. Bartolo, who is waiting for his young ward to come of age because he wants to marry her.
It's a little,
yeah.
Ew,
exactly. But this production is really good, and Lucas Meacham is especially good and very funny as Figaro. He's the barber. Of course, we have the piece in this opera that everyone who has never seen an opera, but who probably has seen Tom and Jerry or Bugs Bunny, actually
soundtrack.
Knows. Yeah, here we go.
It's true. If you watch Warner Brothers cartoons, you've learned your opera.
Right, and that was Lucas Meacham, and that was from a different production, but he's excellent. Highly recommend seeing it. There are performances November 14th, 16th, and 18th at the Detroit Opera House. It is great fun. This is the one. If you've never seen an opera but always kind of curious, This is the one to say.
This is Opera with Training Wheels, just
exactly.
Good for everyone.
There you go.
Now we head north up I-75 to Flint, to the newly formed Flint Repertory Theater.
Yeah, so this used to be the Flint Youth Theater, and it's under new direction. Theater has expanded its offerings from just youth programming to plays and musicals for everybody. So they just opened Assassins this past weekend, which is a Stephen Sondheim musical. The premise of this musical seems a little odd. Like, I would have loved to have heard the elevator pitch for this. And you wouldn't think it'd be fodder for a musical. But it's about the people who assassinated or tried to assassinate a president. So the structure of the show is a bit of a review style. And it portrays the killers, John Wilkes Booth, Charles Guiteau, who killed President Garfield, Giuseppe Zangara, who tried to kill FDR, Lee Harvey Oswald, John Hinckley, who tried to kill Ronald Reagan, and more.
And I know this show has been done at, New York, London, South Africa, Sydney. So let's listen to Neil Patrick Harris singing the Ballad of Booth.
Why did you do it, Johnny? Nobody agrees. You who had everything, what made you bring a nation to its knees? Some say it was your voice had gone, some say it was booze. They say you killed a country, John, because of bad reviews. Johnny lived with a grace and glitter, kinda like the lives he lived on stage. Died in a barn in pain and bitter, 27 years of age. Why did you do it, Johnny? Throw it all away. Why did you do it, boy? Not just destroy the pride and joy of Illinois, but all the USA. Your brother made you jealous, John. You couldn't fill his shoes. Was that the reason? Tell us, John, along with bad reviews.
Sondheim really does cover the decades in this, doesn't
he? Yes, he does. I like the show. The music is excellent. It's a bit of an eccentric show, as many of Sondheim's can be, but strongly recommended.
All right, now we go to Dexter, and the Encore Musical Theater is always doing something interesting.
Yeah, they're doing a big crowd pleaser. Hello, Dolly. This show has experienced a popular revival in New York City with rotating divas taking the Dolly role, like Bernadette Peters and Bette Midler. Carol Channing, of course, made the show popular back in the early 60s, and Barbara Streisand in the film. Our version here at Encore Musical Theater, which opens this coming weekend, stars really one of Michigan's best musical actresses, Marlene Inman, in the title role. She was actually in our studios because she was in the play that I wrote.
That's right.
And she really is wonderful. She did Bridges of Madison County a couple of years ago in the lead role up at the Dio. And
So she is ready to be a diva.
Yes, she's. And the show, for those who have seen it or just heard about it but never seen it, it has some very memorable tunes by Jerry Herman. Title song, of course, Hello, Dolly, Put on Your Sunday Clothes, Before the Parade Passes By, So Long, Dearie. So again, the show opens this weekend and runs right up till Christmas.
All right. And now we're going to continue with the musicals over to the Tipping Point in Northville.
Yeah, this is a sequel to the show Lend Me a Tenor. So there is music involved in this play. The premise, and it's a Farsi kind of romp play. The premise is that there are 3 hours until the curtain opens on the big musical event of the decade, and Tito Morelli is not ready to perform. He's one of four tenors, and there are two wives and three girlfriends. Do the math with four tenors. He's got issues with his daughter. The catering for the thing is all wrong. It's one of those fast-paced, it really snaps along farce as Morelli tries to sort everything out in a very short space of time. But it has a nice message about family.
Okay.
You know, even among this fusillade of funny.
So if you're into farces, then...
Very good. At the Tipping Point in Northville opens this weekend.
And now we're going to really change gears from musicals to a very, very serious drama being done by Open Book Theater in Trenton.
Yeah, they are doing Doubt, which is the play that won a Pulitzer about 15 years ago. Mm-hmm. It dealt with the scandal in the Catholic Church over priests that were sexual predators and how their superiors covered it up. The play was made into a film with Meryl Streep and Philip Seymour Hoffman. It's now playing at the Open Book Theater in Trenton. plays through December 1st. This production is really excellent. I've seen this play before. It sadly remains very relevant as these scandals keep popping up, the latest big one being in Pennsylvania.
And even in Michigan now.
And in Michigan.
There are investigations happening in all of the archdioceses.
This play is set in the Bronx at a Catholic elementary school, kind of mid to late 60s. Priest is suspected of being inappropriate with a student. The writing by John Patrick Shanley. As a writer myself, Shanley is a marvelous writer. He's super tight. There's no flab in his plays. He's clever. He does a beautiful job of exploring the motives of an accuser, the motives and circumstances of a parent whose child is involved being a victim, and the perspective of the accused. And while the subject matter is very heavy, Shanley does a fantastic job of keeping it real and even dialing in some of the natural humor that can happen, you know, between generations, because you have an older nun, you have a younger nun. And it's just a marvelous production. Highly recommended, Open Book Theater in Trenton.
Well, there are lots of offerings, and you can find details on these and more all around the state. Just go to EncoreMichigan.com. David Kiley, as always, thank you.
Thanks so much, Cynthia.
Support for arts and culture coverage comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. As we digest the results of the midterm elections, examining just where things move from solid red to blue, you've got to consider Oakland County. That's where longtime county executive, Republican L. Brooks Patterson, is about to face his first Democrat majority on the county commission. Yes, Democrats will have the majority on the county board of commissioners for the very first time since, well, Gerald Ford was president. With us now is the Democratic County Commissioner from Royal Oak, who is the Democrats' caucus chair. Dave Woodward, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
So the 14-7 Republican majority flips to an 11-10 Democratic majority on the first day in January. It's been over 40 years since Dems controlled the Oakland County Commission. You've been on the board 14 years. Did you ever think this day was going to happen?
Well, we definitely have worked for it for many, many years. But you're right. I mean, I was born the year that Democrats had a functioning majority. But frankly, it was even longer than that before they actually were elected. The last majority was the result of a couple Republicans switching parties in 1976.
So, you know, in the run up to the midterm elections and to when this happened, did you feel something that told you maybe this was going to make this happen?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Actually, I mean, ever since the 2016 election, we have seen a level of activism, people being motivated to get involved in their communities and get interested in running for office. And I would say that this cycle, we recruited the strongest field of candidates who brought a wealth of experience with them. And that was the secret sauce that made the difference in going from a super minority to the majority on election day.
What do you think voters heard that they responded to that turned a solidly Republican party and swung it blue?
Well, I think you have to look at what Democrats, even the minority, have been leading on the county board for the last many years. Years ago, we staked out a claim that we were going to work with our Republican colleagues to make things better for the people that we represented. And we focused on fixing roads and where we led efforts to invest in our local communities to help rebuild those roads. We led efforts to protect school drinking water and replace drinking fountains in all our school districts across the county. We led an effort to protect our lakes. Oakland County's home to more lakes than any other county in the state, and led an effort to protect it from pollution and invasive species. The list goes on and on. And I think that when we look going forward, and all of our candidates speaking from, the same message, investing in our communities, investing in our roads, protecting our water, investing in people, that's what resonated. That's what people heard. And they elected candidates that pledged to do that for the next 2 years.
A big, big issue in Southeast Michigan, I don't need to tell you, is public transit. And absolutely. I also don't need to tell you that Executive Patterson has been one of the main opponents to expanding regional transportation options. How do you see the conversations around public transportation and the RTA playing out with a new democratically controlled county commission?
Well, I think the conversation is a great opportunity for a reset. Public transit, investing in public transit, improving public transit for a host of reasons, which I know that you've covered on your show, the need to get workers to jobs, to meet the mobility needs of an aging population, to connect our communities and attract the next generation of workers, the talent that we need to really help be the fuel that drives our economy. These are all priorities. And our candidates were campaigning on this very issue in these traditionally red areas around Oakland County. And they were resoundingly elected on Election Day. So I hope that sends a message. Like I said, that I think it's a reset for the conversation. As a caucus, we are very interested in helping lead the conversation that's going to result in a solution of improving transit once and for all in Southeast Michigan.
What else would you like to address that you have not been able to because you've been in the minority for so long?
Well, I mean, I think that there's a lot of the things that I talked about that we had focused on over the last many years. I think we want to build on that. We have major problems ahead of us. When we look at our water infrastructure, when we look at our road and bridges infrastructure in our local communities, the state of Michigan has identified and secured some money, but everyone acknowledges it's not enough money to fix the problems. And so what I think that you're going to see us do, we're very interested in taking on big problems. We're not interested in kicking the can down the road. We're ready to take on those problems today and to fix them once and for all and get the job done. In addition to that, transit is one thing, but Oakland County has been a barrier to regional cooperation and regional progress on a host of other fronts. When I look at economic development, you might have heard our county executive came out with all daggers fighting the development of new strategies that Metro Detroit works together to attract investment from around the world, around the country, and what have you. We want to be partners with our neighbors. Oakland County is in a position with our regional partners to be the driving force for Michigan. And so looking forward to working with the new leadership in Michigan. I think we're going to have a partnership with our neighbors all around us to really take on these problems that frankly have been held back because we've had executive leadership and one party control that's held up progress on a lot of fronts.
I'm speaking with Dave Woodward, who is going to be the Democrats' caucus chair as the Democrats win their first majority on Oakland County's Board of Commissioner for the first time since 1976. You talk about this regionalism. What kind of clashes do you foresee with County Executive Patterson as you kind of go down that path?
Well, I'm an optimist at heart. And fortunately, there's been a good tradition on the board of Democrats and Republicans working together. A lot of the initiatives that I outlined were the result of working together and finding common ground with our Republican colleagues to get it across the finish line, get enough votes to make these things happen. Things like protecting the drinking water in schools and investing more money in roads in our local cities and so forth. As we move forward, I mean, I think things that I hope is not going to be necessary conflict. I hope to actually bring the executive with us. When it talks about investing in workers, there's a lot of talk about skilled trades and the lack of enough skilled trade workers for the job demands that are very much on the horizon. We would want to, I mean, get serious and I mean take that on, but you can't do that when you're also advocating for paying them less. And so those are some of the things that I think that we're going to be excited about working again in a regional fashion because the world doesn't end at the 910 square miles that encompass Oakland County. We've got 62 communities, like I mentioned, more lakes than any other county in the entire state. And unfortunately, in a position to be the driver, the economic engine. We're a county that has a GDP and economic powerhouse that's, I mean, frankly, larger than some states in this country. And I'm looking forward to working with the executive, and hopefully we're going to be able to make measured progress to improve the lives of a lot of people.
What do you think all of this means for Oakland County's relationship with its neighbors in Detroit and in Wayne County?
Well, I think it goes without question that we have an opportunity to strengthen those relationships. The degree in which those relationships have been strained due to style or substance. I mean, as far as I'm concerned, I don't know, I don't care, nor do I have the patience for anymore. We have serious infrastructure questions that we got to take on, workforce development issues that we've got to be working together on, economic development strategies we've got to be working on together. To do right by the leadership that's coming up behind us and the young people who are going to be entering the workforce very soon, we don't have time for the barriers to progress that have existed in the past. That 1970s mindset has to change. And myself and my colleagues are very excited to really start those conversations. I think it's a new day in Oakland County to be bold, get things done for the people who elected us last Tuesday.
Dave Woodward, the Democrats' caucus chair, coming in with the first majority on Oakland County's Board of Commissioners in more than 40 years. Dave, thank you so much for talking with us on Stateside.
Thank you so much for having me.
We reached out to Oakland County Executive L. Brooks Patterson. He declined our interview request. Instead, his spokesman sent us the statement that he would release the day after the election, which reads, in part, "The results of Tuesday's election were not unexpected. My administration has always reached across the aisle, especially at budget time, to pass a bipartisan, balanced three-year budget. We will continue to do so." Coming up, in Michigan, more than 92 people are evicted every day.
You might have to live with relatives. You might have to live in a homeless shelter. It really can be a devastating, spiraling effect to your life. And a lot of people get caught up in it.
Evictions in Michigan, next on Stateside. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. There are few things more traumatic in someone's life than being evicted. Princeton University's Eviction Lab has constructed the first nationwide database on evictions and tells us in Michigan more than 92 people are evicted every day. That rate is slightly above the national average. And across the country in 2017, over 2 million Americans were forced from their homes, and very few had lawyers to help them. Brian Gilmore is here now to talk about what this all means to our state, to our nation. He's the director of the Housing Law Clinic at Michigan State University. Brian, in your opinion piece that you wrote in the New York Times called Give Tenants Lawyers, you describe eviction as the civil equivalent of capital punishment. Why do you say that?
Yes, because an eviction really turns your life upside down. I call it civic death, where you lose your status in the community. I mean, you more than likely have been moved out of that community. Your kids might have to change schools. There's no stability to your life. And it becomes like a cycle effect. If you can't back to the way you were, you might be behind. You might have to live with relatives. You might have to live in a homeless shelter. It really can be a devastating, spiraling effect to your life. And a lot of people get caught up in it and they have a difficult time ever getting out of it. So it's like you almost die in society, at least the local societies you're a part of.
And then how does that kind of spread outward? What's the ripple effect that kind of touches everybody in a society when people are evicted?
You might have to depend on other people, so that has impact on their resources. A lot of people here, what we see is they were ending up in the homeless system. And that puts pressure on the resources that Michigan has or the local governments have. It just kind of spirals from there. The money that people think we're saving doesn't really save money. And then the landlords, they will tell you that they lose a lot of money when somebody gets evicted. Most landlords are not hard-hearted. They want to keep the tenants in the properties, but, I mean, they kind of sometimes they just have to move on.
But to the point of your op-ed in the New York Times, this eviction inequity that you write about, what do we typically see in eviction proceedings in terms of who gets a lawyer and who doesn't? What do the numbers tell us?
I mean, it probably differs from state to state, but most of the time the landlords have an attorney and the tenants most of the time doesn't. And usually in most states, when I was in the District of Columbia where I practiced for about 15 years, it was about 90% of landlords had an attorney and less than 10% of tenants. I think here in Michigan, they're probably similar numbers. Some numbers come up like in the 80s, landlords have attorneys. For tenants, it's usually not more than 10%. And that's across the board. even individuals who have some means still cannot afford to pay somebody $200 an hour to represent them in an eviction action.
So walk us through, if you will, Brian, a typical process of eviction to help us understand how would a tenant having a lawyer change that?
What I tried to state in my op-ed was the tenant lawyers, they know the law and they know the procedure. A lot of times in landlord-tenant courts across the country, and I've been able to practice in three different jurisdictions, the tenant just comes down and the tenant thinks that the landlord attorney is like their attorney or has their interests at heart. That person has to represent their client. They can't help the tenant out or anything like that. The tenant doesn't know that they even have a right to certain defenses that are available through the lease contract that they have or through the housing code. They don't know that they have a right to a jury, the right to make counterclaims and things like that. But, you know, on a very basic level, most of the cases aren't like that. The tenant doesn't know that if they had somebody speaking for them, that perhaps they could negotiate a little bit more time for them, or they could point out where some of the charges are not accurate and it might reduce the amount. These are the things that the tenant attorneys can point out. And now that we have an eviction diversion program in Michigan and in other states are picking it up as well.
Yeah, I do want to get to that. Before we talk about that good work that's being done in Kalamazoo with the eviction diversion program, I want to go back to this question that we automatically offer lawyers to someone who's charged with a crime. Why don't we do that with tenants?
That's the question that we've been asking ourselves, as I mean, those of us have been involved in this for many, many years. Like, why can't tenants have lawyers when they go before the court? Because it has wide impact for that community. New York has instituted a program where they actually do have that. I mentioned that in the article, and other states are picking that up as well. It really is a question that we have to face. A lot of times, I know landlords say that that's will slow down the process and things like that. And it might be some truth to that, but there's some rapport between lawyers, between tenant lawyers, landlord lawyers, and a lot of times we talk and then we work out a deal that the person, that at least a lot of the tenants who are facing eviction can handle, as opposed to a deal where it's not going to work. You just gave them a deal where they're not going to be able to pay the money and they're going to get evicted. So we try to fashion deals where they can work. And then, as I said, there's a certain rapport in the lawyer community where they get to know each other. We have respect and things like that. And those things work to the benefit of everybody.
I'm speaking with Brian Gilmore, who's director of the Housing Law Clinic at Michigan State University. And in his op-ed for The New York Times, he calls for giving tenants lawyers because it turns out when landlord-tenant courts are held, mainly landlords have attorneys and tenants do not. And Brian, you point to what the 8th District Court in Kalamazoo is doing with its eviction diversion program. Tell us about that. How does it work? What's different?
Right. So We have a program in Mason here that's very similar, and that program is modeled after their program. And generally what it really is if you would like an attorney on the landlord-tenant day, you can have one. And usually it's a legal services attorney, legal aid, or in our case, it's a legal service attorney or a student clinician who works in my clinic, because I'm part of the law school housing clinic. So if you want one, you can have one, and they would advise you of your rights, some of the rights that I mentioned earlier, and they would also examine your complaint, examine the ledger that the landlord presents to you, examine what you're being charged, and just take a closer look. The other key component of it, and most of the praise for the program goes to Human Services because they're the ones that's kind of behind it, is they Human Services offers some bridge funds for tenants. So that maybe they're behind by a little bit. You can apply for funds, and if you're eligible, you will get a little bit of money, and that might help close the gap of what you owe. And then you pay the other amount, and then you can get on with your life and avoid a bad case of an eviction. And
staying landlord, in your house. Staying. Yes. That's the key, staying in your
right.
house.
And then the landlord can, if that able to work, the landlord can keep a tenant. The system is not perfect, but it's it's definitely better than the system had before, where a person would just be evicted. They would go to the homeless system. The homeless shelters were swelling. So the Human Services felt that that was a bad way to use funds.
And I know you write that the one in Kalamazoo began in 2011, and I'm interested, do the data support what it's doing? Has it been proven to be able to keep people in their homes?
Well, I would say that the data in several jurisdictions has shown that if you have an attorney, you're a tenant in court, there are less evictions, less judgments, less defaults. The outcomes are better. A program in Durham, North Carolina, and they came up and observed our program in Mason, Michigan, and they started a program in that city because of our program, and their data already shows that it's a much better outcomes in all across the board, less evictions, less judgments, less defaults. This has been shown in several jurisdictions now. Even in Lansing had a pilot program. Early results showed that their results are better if you have an attorney representing you in court. It just has a lot to do with the fact that it's a collaborative effort. Lawyers, Human Services, the court cooperating, and it gets a better outcome. That's why they call it the eviction diversion program, because it's looking for a better outcome for everybody.
Now, you mentioned you modeled your program in Mason after the one in Kalamazoo. Lansing has had a program. How widely is this program model from Kalamazoo spreading around Michigan?
Yes, there is a program in Detroit. There is a program in Livingston County. There is a program in Traverse City. Because of the op-ed, I just got a call from Nebraska. There is a program in the starting stages in Richmond, Virginia. So people are beginning to realize that it's probably in everybody's best interest for something like this.
The one thing that I guess we have to address is there's always dollars and cents. So where would the money come from to provide these lawyers to lower and middle income tenants who face eviction?
But I think every jurisdiction kind of makes that decision on their own. Some have money that they are that is being allocated. I know the programs like in Virginia, the state government wants to allocate some funds on some level. New York did the same. In Michigan, our clinic has agreed to cooperate and participate in the program on the day of the housing cases. We come every week if we are able to come to the court. Legal Services of South Central Michigan, who is a stellar program, they come every week. And they also staff the program in Livingston County. So there's really no, on our end, there's no funds or anything, because this is like part of our mission. As for the money for Human Services, that's probably some question that they would have to answer, because they're the ones who provide the rental assistance when people qualify for the program.
But I certainly hear you say that if you are someone who is facing eviction, get help, get legal help. Don't show up to court thinking that the lawyer that's there for the landlord is also going to be batting on your team.
Right. I mean, that's just against the whole idea of an attorney. They're there to represent their client's best interests. And sometimes in the past, a tenant would just walk in, they would go to a hearing, they would ask one question, and then that would be the end of the case, instead of someone really going over their story with them or going over the documents with the other attorney, asking some really important questions. And then, you know, maybe negotiating, because a lot of what we do is negotiation, asking if we can get more time and things like that. And the person will be able to pay. We can make this work. Kind of approach.
Brian Gilmore, director of the Housing Law Clinic at Michigan State University, and his op-ed in the New York Times, Give Tenants Lawyers. Brian, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you.
As we just heard, a number of Michigan cities struggle with evictions and with the social costs of housing insecurity. Three cities, Warren, Detroit, and Lansing, are among the top 100 large cities in America with the highest rates of court-ordered evictions. That's according to evictionslab.org, which tracks eviction data. But there are efforts afoot in cities in Michigan and across the nation to tackle housing issues through the court system. Jake Neer traveled to Cleveland to find out just what they're doing to stem the cycles of housing insecurity and poverty.
The Housing Division of Cleveland Municipal Court is now in session. Honorable Magistrate Sandra Lewis will be
Eviction cases here in Cleveland are handled in a small courtroom in a dark corner of the city's sprawling Justice Center, which takes up an entire city block. Dozens of people are crammed into the courtroom waiting for their cases to come up.
Thank you. You're here on the Housing Division's small claims docket. I've looked at these files and there are a number of issues, so you folks may be in for kind of a bumpy ride here.
According to Eviction Lab, Cleveland averages about 12 evictions per day. That's slightly higher than the national average for a major city. The housing court here is making a concerted effort to reduce that number.
It's kind of amazing. It's like a diversionary court for eviction.
That's Matthew Desmond. He's a researcher and author of the Pulitzer Prize-winning book on America's eviction crisis titled Evicted. He also founded Eviction Lab.
There's full-time social workers in the court that are going to try to address the issue at the moment. And that's a court operation like an institution of justice, not like an eviction processing plant, which is what our status quo is.
The project he's referring to is a pilot program started under the watch of Judge Ron O'Leary, who oversees Cleveland's housing court. It brings in social workers to screen tenants who come to the court. O'Leary says the goal is to see if tenants are eligible for assistance through a variety of programs.
So we may see tenants who are seniors. We may see tenants who are veterans or who have some mental or physical health issues or substance abuse issues.
That program made more than 1,500 referrals in 2017 and has almost reached that number already this year. Since the program has only been in place for about a year and a half, it's tough to compare data year over year. But preliminary numbers show that few people who have gone through this program have returned for another eviction case. And that's significant, since studies show that eviction is cyclical. People who are evicted once are likely to be evicted again. Judge O'Leary says he's encouraged by the results so far.
It was enough positive that I decided to make it a permanent part of what we do here at Housing Court.
But people who work with low-income tenants don't want it to stop there.
There are a number of measures that are sort of a part of the Cleveland Municipal Court that balance the situation a little bit more than some of the other courts that we're present in. But even with that, it's a pretty stark situation for tenants who are facing eviction.
That's Abigail Stout with the Legal Aid Society of Cleveland, which represents tenants who can't otherwise afford an attorney. She says unlike criminal defendants, tenants have no right to an attorney when they're being evicted. Stout is working on a project to increase the number of tenants the Legal Aid Society represents from less than 2% to about 10%. Eventually, they hope to guarantee the right to counsel for all tenants facing eviction. This is something that's already happened in New York City and San Francisco. Melanie Shakarian with the Legal Aid Society says those cities have seen huge benefits.
We know from the data from New York and San Francisco that it's pretty incredible. In excess of like $260 million is saved by kids staying in school, unused shelter beds.
But that's never been tried in the Midwest or a city like Cleveland, Detroit, or Warren. The Legal Aid Society of Cleveland is working with Judge O'Leary at the Housing Court to come up with a program that will provide more legal assistance for tenants who need it. And Shakarian says they don't want it to stop in Cleveland.
We feel like the efforts that we do here can be replicated from Cleveland to Detroit, to Pittsburgh, to Kansas City, to wherever else in the Midwest.
In the meantime, both of those programs are collecting data to quantify evictions and their cost. And that alone is progress, as data related to evictions is notoriously rare and difficult to find. I'm Jake Neer in Cleveland.
There is so much to talk about in our great big diverse state. We can't possibly know about it all, which is where you come in. We want to know what you are curious about. If you've got some kind of question about Michigan, something you've always wondered about, Just send it along by going to the stateside page at michiganradio.org or leave us your question in a voicemail. Just call us at 734-764-7840. That's 734-764-7840. Today's Stateside was directed by Lindsay Scullin and engineered by Peg Watson. Our executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors today are Mike Blank, Mercedes Mejia, April Van Buren, Joey Horan, Sarah Leeson, and Bella Isaacs. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you for listening.